You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future, from research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and welcome to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, I am excited to be speaking to my good friend and colleague, Shelby Scarborough. The theme of this podcast is civility and how civility plays out in the world of behavioral health. Shelby, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Ronit. I'm delighted to be here.
You have such an interesting and diverse work history, and I'm really excited to explore how your concept of civility and the work you do in civility, how that is applied to behavioral health and business and delivery of services. So can we start off with you just giving us some of your background and how you got to, how you started this journey around civility?
Sure. When I graduated from college, I was lucky enough to get a job back in Washington, D.C. in the Reagan White House as an advance person in the advance office. And that was scheduling and working with President Reagan's appearances. And then a little bit after that, I moved over to the State Department to do sort of the same work as a protocol officer. So it's about handling dignitaries and all their needs and make not necessarily about making life easier for them, but it's about making their job easier, making it easier to do their job, taking away all that extra noise around everything so that they can focus and concentrate on what they're there to do and not have to worry about how they're getting there, where they're sitting, what's happening, you know, all the ancillary stuff that takes up a lot of brain space for all of us normal people. I started a company after that when I left government, and because I think I was an entrepreneur at heart, with my family has an entrepreneurial background, and I started a business called Practical Protocol in 1990, basically doing the exact same thing, only from the private sector perspective, with my first client being Nelson Mandela, which kind of launched me into a very interesting trajectory of handling all sorts of dignitaries. We eventually moved into handling dignitaries such as ministers of health from other countries coming to the United States on trade delegations, looking at things like services, standards of care, and equipment, you know, devices and all sorts of medical equipment that would help improve healthcare in the countries from which they came and help our trade balance by having us have companies that were able to sell to these countries. So I learned quite a bit about healthcare delivery, just kind of by osmosis, and everything from the fact that an interesting tidbit is that in Indonesia, I don't know if they've changed this, but when back in the day, they called nuclear medicine, it came out of the their nuclear energy department. So their delegation was all the nuclear officials, not necessarily medical officials. And so there's all these interesting learning curves as we went along. But it was a very interesting journey for me in getting involved in healthcare in sort of a backwards way, an ancillary way.
Before we talk about how civility, you know, kind of the role of civility in healthcare and behavioral health, can you define for us the components around civility, your components, how you break it down?
Certainly. So I just finished a book called Civility Rules, and it looks at George Washington's rules of civility, the founder of the United States. We look at his founding president. We look at the rules that he wrote when he was a child that were translated from a French etiquette book. And so it's all kind of a little convoluted, but what all these 110 kind of funny, interestingly worded rules come down to are some basic things: courtesy, respect, trust, honor, dignity, empathy. Those are the main components of civility. When you wrap them all up in a bow, that's, to me, that's what comprises civility. It's not just about being nice to somebody. It's about understanding what they need and treating them with dignity and respect. It's not about demanding dignity and respect. It's about earning it. So I've sort of analyzed these and repackaged them in a way that I hope, with through telling of personal stories and of stories of people who have been, you know, of high impact through history, that we can learn something from all of them and perhaps create a what I call a practice of civility in our own life, because the theory is that we can't change anybody else, but maybe by changing ourselves, that's the first step to helping impact the world in a positive way.
So if we look at, you know, kind of healthcare in three buckets, if we look at one bucket being the consumer or the patient or the parent of a child, another bucket being the service provider, either the doctor or a behavioral health provider, you know, home health, you know, senior care. And the third bucket is as investors in behavioral health. How would you apply your concepts of civility to those three buckets?
So that's an interesting question. I need to sort of maybe use some examples from my life and hope that they resonate. One of the things, one of the twists and turns in my career was through my time, I ended up becoming an administrator for a pediatric congenital heart center in Switzerland. We built it and opened it in Geneva, Switzerland. And there were some interesting dynamics there. I could spend a lot of time telling you how I ended up doing that, but we brought two famous doctors, famous pediatric cardiac surgeons who were sort of tired of the way medical care was being delivered in the United States. We can go into lots of details on that, but we decided to sort of break the model, break the mold, reinvent it, and launch it in Switzerland as a central place because Switzerland is so tiny that basically everybody comes from someplace else. And children with congenital heart disease always come with their parents. So while the child is the patient, we felt very strongly about treating the whole family because the family needed to be part of the healing process. They needed to be part of the education process on how to care for a child with congenital heart defect, even once they were fixed. And then when using my background in VIP and VIP logistics, we took the concept of customer service to another level. You know, in the United States for so long, and it is changing a little bit, but the concept of, you know, have to stand in line at an admissions desk in a hospital lobby with a child, a baby, infant, newborn who has a congenital heart defect. This was not the right idea. So we made it so that people were picked up at the airport because, again, they were coming from someplace else, brought privately to the hospital. They were taken directly to their room. All of the paperwork was done beforehand, and anything that needed to be done was taken to their room, and the parents were dealt with in their room, in the privacy of their room. Once the parents were able to sleep in the room with their child. And once the child went into the ICU post-surgically, which was standard, you know, you needed to observe a child in the ICU and then go to step down out of ICU and back into the room, into the general population. The parents often in the United States, even to this day, and many cases around the world, are even if they have the opportunity to sleep in some sling or uncomfortable chair in the child's room before they go into surgery, they're kicked out when the child goes into the ICU because that bed is needed. There's no way to do that. So what we did was we made it a package plan, three tiers based on the anomaly. So there was easy, medium, hard, and hard, you know, as far as the anomalies. There's about 30 anomalies and they were bucketed. So if you had PDA, you had, you know, a hole in the heart, you know, that kind of thing, basic stuff, then it was one price. A little bit higher was more complicated was the medium price. And then the most complex was because basically the number of days stay anticipated in the ICU. So long story here, bottom line is parents were right down the hall from their children while they were in the ICU, able to go down and take care of them, be with them, touch them, hold them, look at them, caress them, you know, just put those heart vibrations to their children, which the doctors felt was super, super important in this process. And that the health and well-being of the parents was just, emotional well-being was just as important. So we had social workers there to help them. And then when the baby came back out of the ICU, went back into the room with the parents, they were all able to be there together. The stays ended up being a lot shorter in general. We had great success coming out of the institution. But there was, I can take a pause here, because that was from the consumer side. There is then the physician side and the acceptance of the physicians of this new way of doing things. Now, our team was on board with that, and anybody we recruited had to be on board with this philosophy or they wouldn't have been brought in. But fighting the existing systems of referrals and the doctor population, the cardiologist and cardiac surgeon population in, which there weren't very many in Switzerland, was an interesting hurdle that we had to overcome. And actually we didn't overcome it. We never broke the code on working with the doctors locally. They resisted these outsiders coming in, which I can understand, I guess. And they didn't want to refer. So, and yet these guys were top notch in the world. And in any other situation, they might've sent a hypoplastic left heart syndrome kid to Philadelphia, but they wouldn't refer him to just outside Geneva. So as a result, we had very few Swiss kids, and they were denied care that they could have gotten right down the street. And when those patients found that out, that wasn't very pretty.
Right. I can imagine. Mm-hmm. So there are interesting parallels there because, you know, in behavioral health, specifically in pediatric behavioral health or autism, as you know, that's, you know, my field of specialty. There's a lot of history around the science that we deliver, but now, you know, we talk about contemporary applied behavior analysis, which is a more modernized approach to delivering care. And a big part of that is an eco-behavioral approach, family focused, taking the needs of the whole family into account. So I see a lot of parallels there. Another parallel is you really talk about workplace culture, right? And having doctors and nurses and everybody who's aligned around a culture. And interestingly, there was an article published by Johns Hopkins a few years ago talking about civility and talking about just the amount of the lack of civility, the amount of incivility that they found in their doctors to nurses, doctors to interns. Now, basically, you know, interns are kind of abused during their residency, and then they bring that forward and, you know, speak badly to their interns, and how there's kind of this workplace culture around this hierarchy. And lack of respect, and how they were very intentionally focusing on changing that culture. So how do you see, give me some ideas around work you've done or some examples of work you've done around this, you know, embedding civility into workplace culture, because I think it's such an important piece of not only the experience of the providers, but also the outcomes for the patients and the consumers.
Well, you know, it's a challenge because I think that there's a preconceived notion that the system, the way it's been to treat interns, you know, the way they've been treated, and then it gets passed on like a hazing or a fraternity hazing kind of situation, is the way to do it because it makes people tough and it makes people able to withstand the pressures of the job. And there are a great many pressures. But I think that, you know, I'm not a clinician here, but this is just through the softer side, the soft sell side, the soft skills side of things, that obviously I just think that in my experience, people respond greatly to compassion, to being treated with respect, to being treated with dignity, even if they are the learner, even if they are the student. And we don't need to turn people into robots and to be successful in life. That doesn't preclude us from pushing people to excellence and expecting a high degree. They're not mutually exclusive. It doesn't mean if you're nice to somebody, it doesn't mean it's a weakness. If you're kind to an intern or a nurse or somebody else, doesn't mean that you're going to lose face or lose their respect. In fact, I find it to be the opposite. But when in times of crisis, when you have to demand less civility and more action. In other words, the shorthand of give me this instrument, do this, that if you've built a culture of trust and respect in that, it seems to me in my experience that you end up with a very high functioning team, and you don't end up somebody running out of the room because he talked to me mean, you know, those kind of things, which is it's a frustration, and it impacts productivity, it impacts safety, all those kinds of things, all the way around on every spectrum.
Well, not only that, one of the outcomes that they found of what was going on was that nurses were hesitant to call doctors when they needed help about a patient because of the way they were being spoken to. And so the outcome for the patient was compromised.
Yes.
Because the nurse was avoiding getting support or getting advice. So I would think that, you know, it goes deeper than just how the individuals feel, the professionals feel, but it actually impacts the consumer.
Exactly. So it just seems so logical, but it doesn't seem to happen. the more we can push for this, and I'm very torn between sort of seminars on how to talk nicely to people. There's a difference for me in this. This has to be from the heart. This isn't, you can train for skills as I know that in your world, that teaching behavioral science, teaching skill sets incrementally is an important part of the process, but it doesn't have to be pablum. It can be about appealing to somebody's greater nature, to humanity's greater nature. And this is where maybe I'm a little idealistic, but I really do believe that we don't need a lot of, you know, you better take this sensitivity seminar in order to be successful. I just wish we could get past that and just really figure out how to communicate with each other.
Right. And I think we're seeing that so much today, not that we want to get into politics, but we're just seeing how polarized it's becoming. What did your time at the White House teach you about this, about civility and workplace culture?
you know, I had one of the greatest teachers there ever was, and that was Ronald Reagan, because he was, I'll get all verklempt. He was a, as you know, I want to do, he's a tremendous example, both past, present and future. You know, he's not with us, but he leaves a legacy of civility, a long, long legacy of civility, that he was one of the kindest people, most respectful people I can imagine, while handling one of the toughest jobs there was. He wasn't weak in his leadership at all, but he was kind and he was compassionate and friendly, and he cared about people. He wasn't the same kind of leader that other presidents have a reputation of being. I think Bill Clinton has somebody who has a reputation of being somebody who's very personable, and remembers people's names, which is just a striking quality that I can't remember my own name half the time. So, I mean, that's an impressive thing. George Bush, both George Bushes were the same in that sense. They're very sort of informal people. Ronald Reagan was a more formal leader, but he knew you were there. He recognized you. He didn't just ignore you as part of the woodwork. You know, he knew what was happening. And yet he also knew you had a job to do and he had a job to do. So it just was a great role model to say, look, we can be professional and we go to it, and we don't have to be constantly praised all the time for what we do. We know that our work has value. But at the same time, when there's the opportunity to express your gratitude, to recognize the other person's, even just their presence by nodding and looking at them, because maybe it's not appropriate to have a chit chat at that moment. He was very, very, very good at that and taught me well.
So Shelby, we, you know, we just had the first debate, and there's been a lot of news media coverage around it. It was a very interesting debate. The first time I think we've seen a president and a presidential candidate or a vice president behave that way. And I was just interested, you know, in your comments, your thoughts, given your history, you know, with the White House and President Reagan, kind of what you've seen and what you think.
Well, certainly, you know, I worked for somebody that I consider to be one of the most civil presidents around, was President Reagan. And so seeing what really was a spectacle on stage was disheartening and uncomfortable. You know, at the end, I watched it with my parents. And at the very end, my mother, she was sitting in the chair and she sort of flopped her arms down and stretched her legs out and kind of in a, you know, stretched out position. She says, "I'm exhausted." So I think that's minimally, you know, what people felt one way or the other. And other people felt very strongly. I think it has impacted the way we look at our leaders for a long time. This just either sealed the deal for people or kept them in their corners. I doubt it changed many minds. And that's really the point of civility is. When you look at it in any realm that we're trying to accomplish something in, whether it's be politics or healthcare or, you know, medicine, et cetera, and mental health and all of those kinds of things, we have to be able to hear each other. And if you look back on that debate, you can ask yourself the question, what do I remember of that debate?
That's a great question. Yeah.
Most people don't remember what we would want them to remember. So when I know that you've put on conferences around autism and just trying to get people to hear the story, understand the needs, have compassion and empathy, and be able to help people to reach out into a community they might be unfamiliar with, that's civility. And that was not accomplished in the debates. And as a result, we have this discussion around this isn't a microcosm, the rules of the debate platform are being discussed. And see, I find that to be a larger implication, or really a small example of the larger potential problem, is that once we start dictating rules because people can't control themselves, somebody else is going to control. So if you think of the debate committee, many people say, oh, they've got to get a mute button, they got to tell them this, but if you think about, we're abdicating responsibility to a governing body. And that is where I have a key problem with this whole subject, is we need to control ourselves. We need to behave in a way that other people can hear us. And then we need to take the responsibility on ourselves and not abdicate it to some outside force.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was thinking as you were talking, was it's not about changing the rules. It's about being accountable for behavior and being presidential. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you know, people were commenting, of course, on social media, but one of the comments that stood out to me was preschool teachers should get paid more money.
you know, because that's what it was like, right? Trying to control a bunch of out of control preschoolers who are just screaming and not waiting their turn and talking over each other and being mean.
Exactly.
So it's not about, as you say, it's not about changing the rules. It's about holding people accountable.
Exactly. Exactly. And people have asked me what I would have done. And I started to think about it. If I was Chris Wallace, if I was the moderator, they said, well, maybe the producer should have said something in the background. And I say, you talked about the media just a minute ago. And I said, you know, there's a part of me that thinks the producers could have see them in the background going, this is awesome. And I don't know that, you know, I just sort of envisioned that ratings mean a lot and that you know, the only thing they were missing was the actual mudslinging and the WWE wrestling format, you know, so if they had thrown punches, that would have been all the better for ratings. But certainly that is not what we need in this for, you know, what ratings and what drives media is not what should motivate us. And there's really a fundamental disconnect there as far as what the goals are. Now, Chris Wallace, if I had been him, I don't know, it's easy to say in hindsight, really easy to say in hindsight, but I think my natural instinct would have been to stand up and to physically exert my presence there and basically say, all right, we're taking a break. This is it. Stop. We're leaving the set here. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute and then go to commercial. But I don't know that he had the control over that, you know?
Well, he's in such a tough position, right? Because here you've got the president of the United States and you have to show respect to that chair, mm-hmm. to that seat. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, he's yelling at him to stop talking or yelling at Biden to stop interrupting. But you have to treat them as, you know, the dignitaries that they're, the seats that they hold, the office that they hold.
So I am such a believer in that. That's my complete history is treating people with dignity and respect. And I handled VIPs all my life. But I go back to the issue is they were disrespectful to us. Those two people on that stage were disrespectful to the American people. They wasted our time. And they did not engender trust or respect or humility or courtesy to any of us. And that to me is the essence of that. So they both had their moments. I think that it was calculated that Trump interrupted Biden twice as many times, but saying, shut up, man, to the president. And then the president saying, you shut up. I just, like you said, preschool, that was exactly where my mind went. I said, okay, we are just out of control as a society. And that's I feel they are reflective of society as a whole. Their behavior is reflective of society as a whole. They're not driving our behavior. We're driving our leaders' behavior to a certain extent. I mean, because we need to find leaders who are not going to do this. And now, you know, that aside from policy, we're just talking civility, right? Aside from policy, aside from which person somebody relates to policy-wise, it's out of control. And I just don't... It's unbecoming of the office, and the office reflects us and we reflect the office. So somehow we have to find a way to create our own practice of civility in this world so that we can positively impact our community around us and build that butterfly effect. Maria Shriver has an article. She has a blog post called Sunday Magazine. And in an article, she said, you know, this is us. It's about us. And that's really the premise of my book is it's about us and that we get the government we deserve in a way. So what have we done to deserve this? Well, I think we got to go back and start afresh. And there's lots of places to cast blame, but the only place we have power is within our own selves.
Yeah, I love that perspective. What are your thoughts on kind of COVID and how COVID's playing out? And of course the polarity and the, you know, the discourse between the two sides on how to handle COVID. And of course, now we're seeing it infiltrate through the White House, it looks like.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think from an individual standpoint, it is very difficult. But what we need to do personally is to separate the political spin from the reality, from the science, from the reality. And that's very, very, very hard to do, especially if you're not a medical professional with a medical background. There are some logical things. And from a societal standpoint, from a civility standpoint, which is the only thing I can probably speak to in this case, is it's my personal view that to be courteous as to be trusted and build trust, behave honorably and be courteous to your fellow man, that when we're in tight circumstances, when we're in enclosed places in public, we should wear a mask. I have no idea how effective that is. I am not a medical professional, but the logic tells us that there is something about blocking droplets. And so it may help. It may help, right? I think it probably does. So just given the fact that that's sort of the common belief system right now in the country, that's probably what we should be doing from a civility standpoint. From a health standpoint, over time, it'll all come out. But we're dealing with sort of strange things right now. They don't know. They've learned a lot about COVID in particular, but we know about infectious disease in general. And washing our hands and staying, you know, away from others if we're sick, you know, those are courtesies to our fellow man. And so it's really discerning between the politics and stepping away from politics and calling somebody evil. Or if somebody doesn't wear a mask, it's because they're from one party or another. Or if somebody does wear a mask, it's because, I mean, that's ridiculous. There are people of both parties who do both things. So we just need to monitor ourselves and take responsibility. And now with the president, I think it's interesting from a civility standpoint to think about what you see in social media. I haven't monitored it super closely, but it seems like there's a bit of a dimming of the vitriol. There's definitely a group that is almost gleeful, but I don't see it as hugely. And maybe that's just because I choose not to engage in things that are very vitriolic in general. But there also seems to be a tiny bit of compassion for the fact that, okay, politics aside, he's our president, he's a man, and you know, this would be pretty devastating for the country if this went beyond being 4 or 5 days sick. But, you know, and I do have a hard time when I see people sort of gleefully dancing, doing a dance, because I don't care which party you are. My personal perspective is that that's not an appropriate response. That's not a civil response. Politics aside, you know, I mean, I understand that people are not, that there are people who disagree with his politics vehemently, but trying to take it away from the personal and just make it professional and civil.
So you've also worked, I mean, your consulting work, you've worked with global leaders, you know, including, you mentioned Nelson Mandela, who of course has an amazing legacy, kindness and respect, and, you know, especially the way he treated his captors and his prison guards, you know, on the other side when he became president. You've worked with Pope John Paul II, with the royal family, with Margaret Thatcher. So what did you learn in terms of different cultures, you know, and ethnicities around civility? Are there common threads? I mean, I'm assuming there were common threads. You talked about respect and trust, but were there differences that kind of informed the work you do with businesses?
Yeah, one of the aspects of what I've done over the years with an international bent, why I really like the international scope of working with people from different cultures is exactly that, is culture, is that all of our cultures are slightly different. There's a commonality in us as human beings, but what's fun is, for me anyway, because I'm one of those people who just loves to dig into that stuff and really understand what makes each individual culture tick. So I use an example of in courtesy as an example of what's the difference in courtesies with different countries. So in the United States, and I'd be interested in your perspective on this coming here, you know, coming from South Africa, if it was very different for you, but in the United States, fundamentally, maybe the Western world, essentially, the distance between two people, the courteous distance between two people is about 3 feet. Well, courtesy is something that is transcendent over time. It is timeless, but how courtesy is displayed in the way of manners or etiquette changes with time, changes with sort of fashion, I guess, and changes within cultures. So there are many cultures that have a much closer distance, preferred courtesy distance. So 1 foot in Middle Eastern cultures, in more tribal cultures, the space is less. So you have people who are standing a foot from you, and Americans in particular seem to kind of get a little, like, they don't even know why they're uncomfortable, but they want to step back by one. So if you think of this as a bigger analogy, is we have to be sensitive to these cultural differences, or I like to be sensitive to them, because I think it's the beautiful part of humanity that we have these intriguing distinctions, but it's also a good way to start with, how do I get to a point where we have a point of mutual respect and trust? And just these simple little things, like understanding our social distance. Now, isn't it interesting? As I say, it changes in the times. Right now, an American social distance, and most around the world, is 6 feet, not 3.
I also know that you've worked, you work with female entrepreneurs. You have an angel investment fund that focuses on early stage women-run businesses. you know, in terms of if you think about any businesses, perhaps in healthcare, how does this inform your work when you're working with startups?
Well, in any instance, one of the first things that we look at to invest in is the coachability, the civility, the ability to accept criticism, accept ideas, and to be able to communicate with the investors and be not malleable in the sense of just changing course all the time because it's at somebody's whim or suggestion, but be able to be coachable. So that's a huge, to me, that's a very fundamental element of civility is, do they accept coaching with grace? And a leader needs to be somebody who has confidence, who is assertive, who has focus, all of those things. But they also need to be able to listen, which is a key component of civility, listen to the ideas of others, and perhaps something new comes along that actually informs what they need to do to make their company successful. So as an investor, we want to know somebody's coachable and willing to listen.
Yeah, that's interesting that that's a first step. You know, that makes me think about, you know, I've done quite a bit of work with investors in behavioral health and in autism, and I think we've seen some big deals happen, some big transactions where they're not necessarily successful on the other end. And one of the common threads I see is just a lack of true understanding around or appreciation of the nuances of what it is to invest in autism services, how our services grow. One of the things that has stood out to me quite a bit in the work that I've done is just how the general investment community speaks to the general behavioral health service provider community. You know, in general, service providers are clinicians. They're, you know, very much come from a place of empathy, compassion, want to help. You know, these are not people who are going into this work because they're going to make a lot of money doing it, right? They're really working with kids with autism and with families is tiring, difficult work. Mm-hmm. And so I often see that disconnect when an investor is communicating with this clinician at heart person, you know, about business. And so how do you think, are there trainings around civility, or are they kind of guidelines that you would inform around bridging the gap in those relationships between the healthcare system and the business side?
So as we're growing and shaping our own little investment fund, we focus on women entrepreneurs. It's not 100%, but we focus on women entrepreneurs. I think that it's a good point that the investor comes at things from a hard line too sometimes. And we need it from a civility standpoint, it needs to be a give and take. So just as I said, you asked about what we're looking for in a company is coachability. I think that it goes the same way when you're looking for an investor as somebody who's willing to listen. Same thing goes both ways. Somebody who's willing to listen, listen to understand. And they may be you're bringing somebody in as an investor because they have something to offer into the equation. So they are one part of the equation, just as the founder of the company and the content of the company are all parts of that equation. And so they need to come together to come to the end game of that. That equals success. So it's not just the responsibility onus on the investee, on the person seeking investment, but the investor as well, to not just, I've seen bullies in that industry. And there, I have a picture of one in my head. I hope you can't see who it is because it would be not very civil of me to put that out there in the world. But I can tell you, I witnessed somebody who, Silicon Valley, an investor, and a young person from the Rice University Business Plan Competition came up and asked them for, how do I get in contact with you? And the response was, well, you know, if you can't figure that out, then you're not worth talking to. I mean, really? So I lost a lot of respect for that investor at that moment. And I decided I really didn't want to do much work with that person because, you know, they were okay to have a drink with at a conference, but I just don't want to work with people who don't treat the people that they're working with. They treat somebody they're investing in as their property, or that they must kowtow. And that's just arrogance. I mean, you know, it's not productive. It's just not productive. Well, for the same reason that you said with the nurses and the doctors, how willing is that in that company founder going to be willing to call their investor and be coachable, be open and vulnerable to being coached if the attitude of the investor is, you know, you're not worth my time?
Right. And I think we see this more in as women, because you and I both mentor women to become, you know, entrepreneurs and to grow their businesses. And, you know, that's a whole other topic. But I think, you know, just the importance of paving the way for other people and guiding them along the way and sharing the space, right? There's enough to go around for everyone as opposed to, you know, I'm better than you and the subservience.
And when you say, you know, we talk about bullying a lot these days, and if you don't like a bully, then why be one? I don't see the value in it. There's just none. You know, you get it's so simple. You get a lot more with honey, you know, than anything right. else. And that doesn't mean you're giving up a competitive edge. That doesn't mean that you're not smart and worthy of respect. You're not, it's not weakness to be kind. It is a strength. And that's where I would love to see more of that translated into the business community. Balanced out by due diligence and hard questions. And that's the whole point. We should be able to ask those hard questions, but they shouldn't come across as hard. It's not about the attitude. It's about what you're asking and making sure that we have the right answers that we need. And when somebody's intimidated, it's very often you're not going to get the accurate answer.
Right. And that's going to impact your deal. Mm-hmm. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation. I think your takeaways around your experience in Switzerland and how that not only made the experience so much better, but changed outcomes and improved outcomes for the patients is just incredible and a lesson that can be applied to so many areas of behavioral health. You know, when we think about our aging population and how much support they need, when we think about, you know, families of children with autism, just, you know, just so many areas of behavioral health, right? We're dealing with people who have illness and have a lot of needs for support. So thank you, Shelby, for joining me. It's been really interesting, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Anytime, Rennie. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Rennie Mulco. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.